diplomacy is back at the center of our foreign policy.
My style in diplomacy is my style as a human being.
Diplomacy, John, the job of statesmen.
And I thought it was drinking and dancing.
Well, Jeff Raby has certainly been exposed to the big challenges of recent times in diplomacy, the relationship between China and Australia. He's had various senior postings throughout his career with Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. He has witnessed and dealt with the dramas of Tiananmen Square, for instance, while at the embassy, and he became ambassador from 2007 till 2011. He's continued to comment publicly about the interplay between the two countries and has published as well, often wading into controversy. But as you'll hear, he nominates a quite specific set of qualities and skills necessary, he believes, to be a good diplomat.
Great to be here, Geraldine.
Your personal definition of diplomacy is what I'm intrigued by first. What carried you through your career when you reflect on it?
Well, it's the means by advancing Australia's national interest other than through violence or through the exercise of sharp power. It's a way to get your outcomes in the international sphere whilst leveraging both your resources and your assets, but also your ability to engage other countries in coalitions to help you achieve those outcomes.
And it's through words, isn't it? This is what it's an abstract notion in some ways, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's through words, but diplomacy goes beyond just reading your talking points that have been ticked off by your powers to be in DFAT or in ministers' offices. It's about building relationships with people, and there is an element of trust. And you have to be able to build trust in order to basically, you know, achieve the outcomes you're trying to get. People need to be prepared to listen to you, so you have to be credible. It is words, but it's about relationships, and it's about personality as much as anything else as well.
What do you mean by that?
Well, you have to engage people, and engaging people is not just done sitting across the table, but it's about mixing with people socially, understanding what drives them, what their interests are, understanding their cultures and their background, and using those points in which to bring people around to your point of view. It's a matter of persuasion, the art of persuasion.
The art of persuasion. And do you have to be very widely read? I mean, do you have to consciously learn it?
There are books and guides and things to diplomacy. I've never read one of those help guides or diplomacy for idiots, but I do think you have to be very, very widely read. Now, I'm one who has set
off. You're an economist by training, aren't you?
I'm an economist by training, but also I did economic history, which pushed me into many, many other areas. And rather than mathematical economics, my main interest was economic philosophy. So I came to the subject already with a broad background. But I was going to say that amongst the foreign ministers I've worked for, there have been two really great ones, Alexander Downer, which may surprise people. I guess most people would say Gareth Evans as well. But in both cases, they were people that loved the subject and read widely and constantly. I'd always remember getting on a plane with Downer, and as soon as he settled down, he'd reach out, not for his briefs and cabinet submissions, but for some fat book on political biography or some newly published history. And I think that's the reading you need to do. You have to love the subject. You have to be engaged with history and culture.
And politics, by the sound of it. Very much about politics.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yes, in terms of learning, what are the classic mistakes? People might think that you're really saying you have to do a very, very good cocktail circuit sort of thing in order to get to this next point where you can influence people. And I think that is a bit of almost a parody of the diplomats. By the sound of you, it'd be a mistake to get trapped in that particular zone only.
Yeah, you have to see that as a means to an end. Mm.
But you're not a spy, are you? Because, I mean, John le Carré would have said they were the skills needed as well, but it's something different, isn't it?
Yeah, you're engaging people in an open, transparent and in an official capacity. You're not seeking to encourage someone to betray their government. What you're trying to do is find out how you can work with their government and with them to advance Australia's national interests. But one thing I'd say is very, very important you actually have to have a good memory.
Oh.
That was part of the tradecraft I learned very early on from David Sadlier, who was one of my early ambassadors in Beijing. And he was furious at any of the junior officers who ever took notes during a dinner. And as you know from your own travels to China, yes, sometimes these dinners in China can be quite willing and you have to keep your end up by drinking your share. But then that evening when you get home, or often for me it was the next morning when I wake up, you have to sit down and reconstruct the conversation and reconstruct it accurately and report it to Canberra. And memory is an extremely important thing, and being able to use mnemic techniques, things that will remind you of a conversation, is extremely important.
So what can it reasonably achieve as a discipline? It can seem so amorphous, and, you know, in Australia we're hearing that there's the diplomats' allocations of money, etc., has been declining. The security establishment, which is much more hard-edged, much more tangible, is on the rise. What would you say to them? What can diplomacy realistically achieve in this world?
Well, from an Australian point of view, where we're a relatively small country with a very, very big landmass to protect, we have actually nothing much other than diplomacy. There is no way we could spend the money to defend Australia through military means. We have to work diplomatically to secure our peace and security. And diplomacy by Australia has a strong tradition of having achieved that. I mean, we have been in the past, not now, as you say, we are running down the resources in diplomacy. We have weaponized much of our foreign policy. If you see with the announcement by the foreign minister that they're going to rip up the Victorian government's Belt and Road agreements, empty MOUs, which are nothing more than an expression of good intention, to do things like that is really weaponizing foreign policy. So we have gone in a different direction, but in the past we were good at building coalitions, engaging countries around core issues of Australia's interest. Things like the Cairns Group of Agricultural Free Traders basically put agriculture into the world trading system of rules. Gareth Evans led brilliantly with his Indonesian colleague Ali Alatas, the Cambodian peace settlement. I was heavily involved in the creation of the regional process, the Bali process of on people smuggling with my then colleague, Marty Natalegawa from the Indonesian Foreign Ministry. And so it goes. We have a great tradition in Australia of active middle power diplomacy, working with like-minded countries and some that aren't quite like-minded, but building coalitions to advance our interests.
I mean, it's not just here. It's in the UK. The Foreign Office is not anything like what it was. The whole Biden administration is trying to build back the State Department. So something has happened. I mean, it sounds to me as if diplomats haven't actually won the art of persuasion with their own governments.
Yeah, a very good point. And I think that's absolutely the case in Australia. Certainly, I think with the United States, we had something of an aberration with Trump. And I wouldn't see that as indicating a trend. It's to be very welcome that Biden is moving back towards a greater emphasis on diplomacy. And with the UK, that may be true, but UK and many other European states and many states invest far more heavily in diplomacy than we do. The Lowy Institute has sort of does an annual survey on this, and we rank for our per capita income well below where we probably should be if you look at market countries.
So its prestige has definitely dropped. Another suggestion that's been made to me is that these days prime ministers pick up the phone to other prime ministers and don't think they have to bother about pesky things like diplomats.
Well, ever thus. And it's very, very important that prime ministers are personally engaged in diplomacy. I mean, picking up the phone to another president or prime minister is another form of diplomacy, and it has always been like that. I think you touch on another point, though, and that is communication has changed the nature of diplomacy profoundly. And the telephone is an option, although I remember once Malcolm Turnbull complaining to me that Premier Lee Ka-chung would never pick up the phone and answer his calls, even though Lee Ka-chung speaks perfect English. And I guess that's part of a diplomatic rebuttal by the Chinese.
Yes, so not picking up the phone is quite a statement too.
Exactly right.
If you were still there, you're talking about the business of finding common ground and working out how you influence people. With the type of highly emotive, very aggressive tone from the current Chinese foreign ministry and the diplomats who seem to very much enjoy sort of hogging the podium here in Australia and there, how would you just approach, I mean, even the wording, how does one approach people like that and suggest that there might be other ways to deal with us?
Well, from where we are now and the hole that we're in, it's very difficult to see how we move forward from this point. And it's going to take really head of government engagement. And it's about fundamental policy and, frankly, the policies we've chosen. I think we could have dealt with those choices more diplomatically. I think we didn't have to be, on so many occasions, the first out of the starting blocks in terms of criticising China, as we were with Huawei. We didn't have to take such a high profile. We could have gone into the question of, as ultimately happened, an inquiry into COVID in like-minded company, having consulted allies and friends. We could have done things a lot differently. We didn't. And I think it's going to be extremely hard to find a way out of the hole that we're currently in.
And if you, as the diplomat on post, actually has a country condemning aspects of the country that you're representing at that particular time, that's also the right of your own country, isn't it? How do you deal with that, a la Xinjiang and South China Sea and so on?
No, absolutely. My advice would always be make sure the way you go forward with your message is likely to produce some sort of positive response on the other side that is constructive and not counterproductive. But public, broad brush, sometimes not completely well-informed criticism is extremely counterproductive. And in the case of China, you have to also reflect the fact that culturally, things like face, and prestige and pride, particularly of the leader, matter enormously. So you need to package and shape the message in such a way that you don't gratuitously make Chinese lose face.
And you never saw that as appeasement?
No. I mean, you're not changing your policy position. You're not stepping back from your core interest or your core values. You're just being clever and smart in terms of how you package things. And as I've written many times in my various columns, we have managed to make ourselves an outlier. Other countries who share the same liberal values as we do still manage to maintain normal, diplomatic, official and trade relations with China, whilst pressing on China their concerns about aberrant behaviour.
I wonder if you'd even suggest any reading that people could undertake to grasp this rather amorphous discipline better.
Well, I guess as a realist, I turn first to Henry Kissinger. And he's condemned and criticised in many quarters, but I think he's a masterful statesman in terms of the tradecraft and also the statecraft. And his tome on diplomacy is an excellent starting point. And certainly, I think in understanding China, his other book on China is also and world order. So there's three great books by Kissinger. And they're full of excellent pointers to the literature in different directions.
There's a sense almost that, you know, could you trust Henry? You know, he walked both sides of the street. I mean, this is exactly what people used to say about the old Foreign Office, you know. Oh, you know, where do they actually stand? But your point is that that is a chosen position often for a particular outcome.
Yeah, absolutely. It is about advancing your national interests. And if you need to walk both sides of the street at some times, you walk both sides of the street. That one of the biggest threats to diplomacy is ideology, and you can't be an ideologue and be a diplomat. And I think we need to be very careful we keep these things separate. And we're coming up this year to the remarkable event that occurred 50 years ago when Gough Whitlam went to China, when our troops were in Vietnam dying in the fields to keep the Chinese out from occupying Southeast Asia. Whitlam went in an amazing display of leadership and insight. And whilst being condemned in the parliament, and the Prime Minister, Billy McMahon, came within a whisker of accusing Whitlam of treason for going, who should pop up in Beijing 3 days later? None other than Henry Kissinger. Announcing that a fundamental change in the US position to China was about to take place. And it was done because that served US interests.
I just wonder what your best memory, dare I ask you for that, of your time as a diplomat.
That's a tough one. I found myself when I was ambassador to the World Trade Organization put into a most unenviable position by Tim Fischer, who was then Deputy Prime Minister and Trade Minister. We had been in this endless battle in Geneva over who to appoint as the next Director General of the WTO. There was Mike Moore from New Zealand and a former deputy prime minister, Super Chai. And strangely, for most people, Australia decided to back Super Chai over Mike Moore. And Alexander Downer had a set against Moore on philosophical and political grounds. And Tim Fischer, as we know, was very close to Thailand. So they both wanted me to ensure that Super Chai was elected. The Americans backed Mike Moore partly because it was the Clinton administration and Barshefsky was close to the unions and Mike Moore was a Labor guy and so on. And the whole organization was virtually paralyzed over this, and it was very nasty and very bitter. And at a general council meeting when Fischer was in town one day, he said Jeff would negotiate a circuit breaker and resolve the problem. And strangely, the rest of the organization accepted that I would lead on the diplomacy to try and resolve that issue. And it took ages. It was a remarkable experience, but it was about, again, building up from a very small base coalitions that thought there was a potential compromise. In the end, we negotiated a split term, 4 years each.
Oh, very interesting. Mm. Oh, yes, quite an achievement. Well, look, Jeff Raby, thank you very much indeed for joining us as part of this series. I do appreciate it.
My pleasure, Geraldine. Thank you.
Jeff Raby, on his long career with the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, one he clearly enjoyed. And that ends our Modern Diplomacy series.